Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly analysis of major economic events and trends, the forces, both national and global, that shape our economies, our income, our taxes, our debts, literally what we do in the economic dimensions of our lives. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life at several universities. Currently, I teach as a visiting professor in the Graduate Program for International Affairs of the New School University in New York City. I also write columns of economic analysis for the website truthout.org, a courageous source of independent news, news analysis, and commentary every day. If you're interested in the kinds of analysis we do on this program and would like to pursue them, please be aware that we maintain two websites available to you free of charge 24/7, and we put a lot of material on there precisely to elaborate and extend what we do on this program. The first website is rdwolf.com, and the second website is democracyatwork.info. Please be aware that not only do they contain these sorts of materials to help you pursue the kinds of analysis we perform here, but they also provide you, both websites do, with a way to send us your comments, your criticisms, your suggestions, and your questions, which we then use to design and plan our programs so they are more effective in dealing with the questions you're interested in. So once again, you can communicate to us with whatever is on your mind by going to either rdwolf.com or democracyatwork.info. And finally, please do remember to follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Turning to our updates, the short ones with which we begin every program, I wanted to, and I hope you're not getting tired of this yet, turn to yet another banking scandal. Before I get to the new one that's exploded over the last week, I want to remind you that banks, major banks in the United States, and indeed in many other countries, have already been caught, exposed, and required to pay huge fines, not huge for them, but huge for what we're used to, for doing the following things: illegally and unethically manipulating interest rates around the world. This was known as the LIBOR scandal and is continuing as the investigative agencies around the world probe what the banks did. Second, banks have been caught and fined for money laundering, taking the money of illegal and criminal interests and moving it through the banking system so it can't be detected as to its origins. Third, for charging excessive fees to credit card users, borrowers, and others. And finally, a couple weeks ago, huge fines for manipulating the mortgage market. So, well, what's new? Well, now it turns out major banks also manipulated the foreign exchange market. Let me briefly remind everyone what that is. Whenever you buy something from a foreign country or we sell something to another country, there has to be a change of currency. The country selling has a different currency from the country buying, and so there has to be a working out of the exchange of one kind of money for another. Banks do most of that. It's called the foreign currency market. And it turns out that major banks were manipulating that market. To give you an idea of how much of this kind of transaction happens, it is reputed to involve $5 trillion worth of exchanges every day. So now more and more suits are emerging, governments are investigating. It is so grotesque that a perceptive comment by Matt Taibbi in a issue of the Rolling Stone magazine of 6 November makes an interesting point. There are now so many suits multiplying that the banks are going to be quickly put in the following situation. They're going to say to the public, you have to bail us out from all the bad we've done, and all it's going to cost us, because if you don't, the banks will collapse and it'll be even worse for you. And that confronts all of us with the following. We are going to have to come up with a vast additional money to bail out the private banks whose unethical, illegal manipulations have not only brought us this crisis, but cost so much money that there's really no way for this system to work. In a rational society, this situation would long ago have led people to understand that relying for our monetary system on private profit-seeking banks generates a level of abuse, illegality, waste, and risk that makes it absurd not to make a transition to public banking that would at least be transparent and accountable in a way that the private banks never are, unless they need us to bail them out from their failed speculations and their shady deals. The second update for today is also about banking, but this time banking in a particular country, Ireland. Ireland did a strange thing. It went on a boom in the early years of this century, led by its, how surprising, private banks. And those private banks lent money to folks who couldn't pay it back, made speculations which went bad, abused their near-monopoly power in the money markets of Ireland. And so when the crisis of capitalism hit in 2007 and 2008, the banks collapsed. But when they did so, they turned to the government, which bailed them all out. And the way it went in Ireland was as follows. The government of the people of Ireland simply guaranteed all the debts, all the deposits placed in these private banks. In other words, when the private banks failed, lost money, became unprofitable, got caught up in unspeakable lawsuits, the government simply came in and bailed it out. Private bank debts became the debts of the whole Irish people, as in the Irish government. And when foreigners who had lots of claims on Irish banks because they had lent them money demanded to be paid back, the Irish government honored the debt. That's quite different from what the Icelandic government did, as I have reported in earlier programs. So where does that leave Ireland? In a terrible condition. It can't afford to work its way out of the crisis because it is overloaded with debts to both private interests in Ireland and foreigners, and it has to use all its resources to take care of them. Results. Unemployment in Ireland today, 13.5%. That's nearly twice the rate of the United States, and the United States has a serious unemployment problem. Back in 2006, unemployment in Ireland was 5%. So you can see we're cutting close to three times the unemployment rate before this crisis hit and before the Irish banks went belly up. And the 13.5% unemployment in Ireland, of course, doesn't count the tens and perhaps hundreds of thousands of Irish young people who have been emigrating from that country, as so often happened in the long history of Ireland, because they can't get work, because they can't have a future, because they can't survive. Nor is that all. Desperately trying to raise money, the Irish government is selling off the assets of the Irish people. Gas and power facilities built with public money to serve the public interest are being sold to private profit-making capitalists. The government of Ireland has a 25% stake in the Irish airline Aer Lingus, and it's putting that up for sale so that the government will no longer have any say over what kind of international air service connects the island of Ireland to the rest of the world. The official of the International Monetary Fund, who used to be in charge of Ireland, refers to the conditions there as, quote, drastic. So serious are the problems of Ireland, Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, and other countries that a tiff erupted over the last month when a report prepared in the International Monetary Fund came up with the following idea. We might need, the writers of this report said, a wealth tax across the world, or at least across Europe, and a significant one, 5-10%, to raise the money to save and bail out the banks. That's right. The failure of private enterprise banks through their own speculations, their illegal behavior, and so on, may have to be paid for by generally tapping the wealth of everybody in Europe. This is extraordinary. This is literally Robin Hood in reverse. You're going to tax everybody to keep going a decrepit, failed, illegal, impossible private banking system. Fortunately, there is a movement in Ireland called the Public Banking Forum of Ireland, which is taking the lead in pushing in Ireland for the obvious solution, which is to build up a network of public banks that will not behave in the disastrous failure manner of private banks in Ireland. And what goes for Ireland goes for other places too. Third update. Johnson & Johnson, a leading pharmaceutical company in the United States, agreed over the last week to pay a fine of, ready, $2.2 billion in civil and criminal penalties to settle accusations that it improperly promoted the antipsychotic drug Risperdal to older adults, children, and people with developmental disabilities. Let me say that again. The private enterprise pharmaceutical company Johnson & Johnson improperly promoted an antipsychotic drug to older people, children, and folks with developmental disabilities. I can't say what's in my mind, so I'll just quote to you what was said by United States Attorney General Eric Holder in announcing the agreement he had gotten from Johnson & Johnson. I'm quoting now Mr. Holder. Recklessly put at risk, he's referring to J&J, recklessly put at risk the health of some of the most vulnerable members of our society. Well, that's being really polite. But lest you think that there's anything exceptional about Johnson & Johnson, let me point out that there have been similar agreements reached over the psychological drug Zyprexa with the Eli Lilly Corporation, Senoquel with the AstraZeneca Pharmaceutical Corporation, and Depakote with the Abbott Pharmaceutical Corporation, now with the new name AbbVie. And indeed, SmithKline and Pfizer, the two remaining giants of private profit pharmaceuticals, have also reached recent agreements. What do we have? We have here examples, first in banking and then in the pharmaceuticals, of private capitalist enterprises pursuing profits in a way that bankrupts entire nations, risks the economy of the world, and literally undermines the health of old people, children, and folks with developmental disabilities. What can one possibly say in defense of a system with such results? Fourth update. This will come of particular interest to those of you that use airlines. American Airlines, United Airlines, and others have recently announced that they are adding a seat in coach. I here rely on a Wall Street Journal article in Wall Street Journal Online of October 23rd. This caught my eye. The seats, in order to add another one, all the seats will have to become narrower, so that the seat that you will be sitting in an airline, if you unfortunately travel in coach, will now be 17 inches across. Let me explain. That is over 20% narrower than what you would sit in a business class or first class seat. And indeed, the airline spokespersons explained to the Wall Street Journal that they had to enlarge their first class and business sections because they can charge so much more money for those seats. They wanted to enlarge them, but that left less room for coach, but they didn't want to give up any seats they could sell in coach to the average folks. So the solution, this is capitalism's way of working, was to cram more of us into the already unbearable narrowness of the seats in most coach sections. So let me make clear what's going on here. Like in so many other areas of our society, as the gap between rich and poor widens, the system accommodates. The poor have to travel in coach. They couldn't possibly pay for business or first class. So we're going to cram more of them into the coach, making their trips more uncomfortable, in order to satisfy the rich, the terrible minority, who need to have roomy, pleasant, airy seating areas in travel. You know what this is? This is travel for the elite and travel for the mass. And the elite will be comfortable and the mass won't. That's how capitalism works, and that's how it's going to impact you and me. In the last brief update today, I wanted to make you aware of an interesting study. The author of the study is Mark Rank, R-A-N-K. He's a professor of social welfare at Washington University and the co-author of the forthcoming book, Chasing the American Dream. And what he does in his research, in the book and in a recent op-ed in the New York Times, is to talk about how poverty in America is not what many people think it is. It's not something restricted to slum areas in densely populated urban disaster zones. No, he points out that poverty is something spread across the lifetimes of Americans and across the countryside. He gives some statistics I want to point out to you. 54% of Americans, 54%, a majority, will spend at least 1 year of their lifetimes in poverty or near poverty. That is, they'll be at or below 150% of the poverty level. And let me assure you, folks, that's poor. Here's another statistic. Half of all American children will at some point during their childhood reside in a household that uses food stamps for a period of time. Now, it doesn't take advanced rocket science to understand that families going through poverty for a year, children living in circumstances where they rely on food stamps, are people going through poverty that has all kinds of effects on their physical health, their mental health, their prospects for education, for advancement, for career development, you name it. And so what is being done by Mr. Rank, Professor Rank and his associates, is teaching us the pervasiveness of poverty. He says, in fact, it's not concentrated in our urban areas. In recent years, it has been found, quote, throughout a variety of urban and suburban landscapes, as well as in small towns and communities. This dispersion of poverty has been increasing over the past 20 years, particularly in our suburbs. Last point he makes. In a bizarre twist that he finds mysterious, Americans seem to think not only that poverty is concentrated and affects few people when the opposite is the case, but they also seem to think that people in poverty get all kinds of help from the government. Here's what Mr. Rank, who's done the research, finds. Quote, We currently expend among the fewest resources within the industrialized countries in terms of pulling families out of poverty and protecting them from falling into it. And the United States is one of the few developed nations that does not provide universal health care, affordable child care, or reasonably priced low-income housing. Now, here comes the sentence I want you to think about as I quote from Professor Renk. As a result, our poverty rate is approximately twice the European average. Wow. Wow. Something to think about. Okay. We turn now, as we often do on this program, to a major discussion of a major problem. And typically, these are problems that you, in your comments, sent to us through our two websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. These are comments and discussions based on what you have told us. So the first one concerns the teaching of economics at university level. And over the last couple of weeks, there has been quite a to-do about the protest of students at Manchester University in Great Britain. They formed themselves into what they call the Post-Crash Economics Society. That is, these are students who say that based on the crash of capitalism around the world that began in 2007, it has become clear to them as students that mainstream economics, what they were taught in their university classes, is not appropriate, not adequate, and that they are badly in need of having teachers able and willing to teach alternative theories to the neoclassical economics, as it is officially called, that is taught in their university and indeed in so many. They point out that their professors did not see this crash coming. They point out that their professors are advisors to governments that seem stunningly unable to overcome and end this crisis. They argue that their professors have indeed spent most of their classes celebrating the efficiency, the growth potential, the equity, the fairness, and indeed a whole lot of qualities of the modern economy which these students don't see around them and only hear about in a classroom that they find more and more fantastic. So this leads me to offer a few suggestions about the training of economics. And I should explain that I've been a professor of economics in many American universities, and for those of you who don't know, I'm also the product of the American university system. I began studying economics at Harvard as an undergraduate. I went on to get a master's degree at Stanford University in California, and I completed my education with a PhD in economics from Yale University. Under normal circumstances, folks would look at that as a reasonably good training in economics. So here's what I have to say. First of all, congratulations to the students at Manchester. They have become able to see what many of us have been trying to say for a long time, that the conventional economics that dominates American and many other countries' universities, this celebration of capitalism, is, to say the least, very partisan, very biased, and very particular. That an honest, open education would present to students the neoclassical celebration of capitalism, but would at the very least also give them a thorough education in the critique of neoclassical economics that comes from the school called Keynesian economics after the British economist Keynes, a person who loved capitalism, by the way, but who thought that left to itself, it would destroy itself, and that it needed the government to step in to get the benefits of capitalism and to prevent the flaws and dysfunction of the system. So students should learn that. They mostly don't. And even more, that students should learn the perspective, the kind of economics that comes from people who don't celebrate capitalism, who are critical of it as a system and think that modern society can and should do better than capitalism. And of course, the most important school of economics that does that is Marxian economics. Keynesian economics is largely excluded from modern programs teaching economics. Marxian economics is almost totally excluded. No intellectual honesty and no recognition of the need for people to understand alternative perspectives in a time when capitalism is working, to be as kind as I can, poorly. There's no justification for this. It's pure fear on the parts of the people who run our universities and our society to have students confront the kind of critical perspectives that the times need and that, yes, might persuade students that they ought to join those who think that we can do better than capitalism. If you are interested in a systematic comparison among neoclassical, Keynesian, and Marxian economics, then you share a perspective I have, because I'm interested in that, and I believe students should and could handle that. And as a result of that, together with another professor, Stephen Resnick, I wrote and published a book last year that I would like to urge you to take a look at. The authors are Richard Wolff, myself, and Stephen Resnick. The title is Contending Economic Theories, Neoclassical, Keynesian, and Marxian. The publisher is the MIT Press in Cambridge, a very traditional, mainstream producer of economics works. It is the place where probably more Nobel Prize-winning economists have taught than any other, whether or not you think that's much of an achievement. But here is a book that is now used in many colleges and universities across the country, where you have at least a faculty member willing to buck the trend and actually expose students systematically to a book that compares neoclassical, Keynesian, and Marxian perspectives so that students can begin to make use of them and think about them and integrate them in their own work. Last point. To understand why economics is so biased, so narrow in the way that it's taught, it's helpful if you recall an enormous peculiarity about economics in the United States. If you look at most universities, you will see they have a single history department, a single literature department, a single biology department, a single you name it. But in economics, it doesn't work like that. In economics departments, where I've spent my entire adult life as a professor, mostly what is done is what I would call celebrating capitalism. You don't teach students how the system actually works. You give students endless exercises in ways in which this system is asserted to produce efficient outcomes, to work smoothly, to have a stable equilibrium, things like that. These are all rationalizations, celebrations of a system. But you don't have to take my word for it. Take a look at any textbook. But you don't even have to let that guide you. Let me point out the peculiarity that in every American university, the business community long ago figured out that economics departments do not teach the young people they plan on hiring how business actually works. How you grow a business, how you organize a business, how you market a product, how you expand, all the things a business wants its young people to have learned in school, economics didn't teach. So guess what? In every university, there's a second economics department. Its job is not to rationalize, justify, and celebrate capitalism. It doesn't need to, because that's what the economics department does. This second economics department goes by the name Business School. And if you want to learn how a business works, you go to a business school. If you want to take a course in why the system is the best thing since sliced bread, and you will not be bothered by alternative analyses that reach different conclusions, then go to an economics department. Folks, this is halfway through our program. I want to thank you for being with me for the first half. Please stay with us. In a very few seconds, we'll be back for the second half of Economic Update. This is Richard Wolff. I look forward to talking with you again in a matter of seconds. Welcome back. This is Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff, and we're in that section of our program where we talk about major issues in the news that deserve a little bit more analysis. So I'm now going to turn to a question of the relationship between the unemployment we have in the United States and the number of job openings that get announced. This is a very important ratio. It's called the ratio of job seekers to job openings. And the statistic is kept by the Bureau of Labor Statistics in Washington, and a recent article by Heidi Scherholz of the Economic Policy Institute in Washington brings to our attention the relationship. Basically, the ratio of job seekers to openings is about 3 to 1. Let me make sure you understand what I'm saying. The number of people looking for work is 3 times larger than the number of job openings advertised by employers. The first thing to understand about that statistic is that it puts to rest, or ought to, the claim you sometimes hear from conservative, business, or right-wing thinkers that somehow the jobs are there and that the unemployment is explained by people who lack the brains or the motivation or the drive to go look for them. The truth of the matter is, as the government reports and as everyone knows who pays attention, that we have unemployment because, in the words of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the job seekers are 3 times larger than the job openings. But I want to go and take this idea a bit further with you. I want to examine what is rarely discussed, which is, what are the costs of all of this unemployment? The official rate in the United States, about 7.5% now, is huge. It means millions of people have no work. If you add those who have stopped looking, and you add those who have a part-time job but want a full-time job, then we're talking about many millions, 10, 20 million Americans. So let's talk about what that's like in economics. First, what we lose is what these people could produce. I have said this before, but it's worth saying again. We have 20 million, give or take, people who want to work a full-time job. That's what they want. They're looking for it. They seek it. They need it. At the same time, according to the Federal Reserve of the United States, roughly one-fifth, 20%, of our tools, equipment, floor, store, space, factory, machinery is sitting idle. That's right, 20% of the raw materials, tools, and equipment, store space, factory space, office space, is sitting idle. If we put together the people who want to work with the tools, equipment, and raw materials they need to work with and on, the output would be measured in the trillions of dollars. That's what we're missing out on. That output could change poverty overnight. That output could transform our society. What we lose with unemployment is an immense wealth that we could otherwise have. Does that then justify doing nothing to overcome it, living with it these last 6 years? Let me look at this unemployment and problem a second way. What are the costs directly of high unemployment? I don't mean now what we don't do in the way of production that we could and should do. No, no. I'm saying, what are the costs of all those people unemployed? Well, here's what we know. We know that unemployment is associated with physical illness, mental illness, alcoholism, family tension, family breakup, divorce, criminal activity. Wow. The more you put people in an impossible unemployment situation, the greater the strains, and all of the things I just mentioned incur costs. Extra medical costs for mental and physical disease. Extra support for people, whether it be food stamps or unemployment compensation. There are enormous billions and billions of dollars of costs. No corporation calculates those as costs, most of them, but they're real costs in our society. Unemployment not only means we don't get the output those people would want to produce, by the way, an output that would be more than necessary to pay them. So nobody else has to pay them. They will be paid by the output they themselves produce, just as in any other economy. But not only do we forego the output they could produce and the payment that would be for them and the benefit for all of us, but we also incur the enormous costs of not doing it. And here's a last point. Suppose we believed, I don't, but let's suppose, for the sake of argument, we believe that we really have 7.5% more people than there are jobs. Okay? We have more people than there are jobs. Another way of saying that is, we have 7.5% more capacity to work than we need work done. Okay? There's two ways to handle that. The way we do, which is to say to 7.5% of the people, okay, the economy doesn't need a lot of work, so we're going to take it all out on you. You're going to have no work at all. You're going to be unemployed. You're going to suffer all the strains and stresses that go with unemployment. But there's, of course, an alternative way. You know how you could handle the excess of 7.5% people over the work we need done? You would cut everybody's work week by 7.5%. That works out to about 3 hours. So instead of the average work week being 40 hours in this economy, it would be 37. Everybody would be working 37 hours and getting 37 hours worth of pay. Everybody would be getting 3 hours of leisure they didn't have before. But since the companies need that work to be done, that used to be done by all those people working 40 hours, they would have to hire the 7.5% unemployed to do the work that the average 40-hour-a-week person wasn't doing anymore because it was reduced to 37. In simple English, this is called sharing the unemployment, making everyone in society deal with something which is never the fault of those people that are told it's all going to come out of your hide. Our society's imbalance between what we want produced and what we have in the way of workers is going to be solved by making some workers completely outside the system. That's not efficient. That's not fair. That's not democratic. But you know why that happens? Because if everybody had to cut their work, then suddenly everybody had to cut their income. then suddenly everybody would realize whether unemployment really is a good idea because it affects you, each of us. And then maybe we'd have a society that would recognize the absurd costs and wastes of unemployment in a capitalist system and would not permit that to continue. Finally, I want to talk a little bit about a statistic that has been getting more and more attention. It's called labor's share. And here's what it means. Capitalists figure out how much of the output produced in our factories, offices, and stores is going to wages and salaries, income of people, and how much of the output is yielding profits and interest to capitalists. In other words, how do we share out the output produced by labor and capital between the two of them? And the statistics here are crystal clear. In the 1990s, labor's share was in the neighborhood of 66%. And in the new century that we're in now, the labor's share has been dropping, and it is now around 62%. In other words, the portion of output going to working people, workers, earners of wages and salaries, is shrinking. And the portion of output that's going to the owners of businesses is rising. What about that? Well, it shows up in a number of ways. But the one that's most dramatic and the one that most of you are likely feeling is a reduction in your wage or salary, or a reduction in your benefits, or a combination of both of them, or having to spend more hours without being paid more, or having to be an intern who isn't paid at all. There's an endless way that this works itself out, but they all have that one thing in common. You're working more, you're working harder, and you're getting less. Why does that happen? And the answer to that has to do with the way capitalism as an economic system works. And the best way I know to explain this is as follows. A capitalist is always troubled, worried by rising wages. The more the wages a capitalist has to pay rise, the more urgently a capitalist looks for a way to solve that problem. Because for the capitalist, rising wage cost is a problem. And the traditional ways that capitalists in the North America, Western Europe, and Japan, the traditional way over the last 30 years that capitalists have responded to the high wages of their workers is one of two things, or sometimes both. First, move production from Western Europe, North America, and Japan, where wages are high, to other parts of the world, Asia, Africa, Latin America, where wages are low. And the second way capitalists respond is to replace high-wage workers with machines, computers, robots, whatever. Now, let's make sure we understand what I'm saying. Capitalism is a system in which the success of workers to push up their wages so that they can live comfortably, provide education to their children, put away some money for their old age. The more workers are successful in raising their wages, the more incentive their employer to undermine their raised wages, to undermine the comfort in life they have achieved, to either move production abroad or replace the workers with machines, driving down the wage. Nothing could better illustrate the fundamental reality of capitalist economic systems as being a conflicted system in which workers and capitalists have opposed interests that are central to the way the system works than what I've just said and what we are now experiencing. The United States was a place where wages rose for a long time. Most of the 19th century, most of the 20th century, until around the 1970s. At that time, conditions changed. Capitalists no longer had to pay higher wages, so they chose not to. They replaced workers with computers on a massive scale, and they moved production out of the United States to other parts of the world, first and foremost to take advantage of the cheaper wages and salaries there. And that's still going on. The result is capitalists responded to 150 years of rising wages, not by saying, wonderful, what a wonderful country the United States that is able to provide rising wages for 150 years and a comfortable lifestyle for its people. On the contrary, the way capitalism works, those high wages became the problem for capitalists to solve by automation and by the export of jobs, so that now we live with the fruits of that capitalist strategy and that capitalist feature. The wages we won are the reason we're losing those wages. And if this strikes you, excuse me, as inappropriate, unbearable, unjust, undemocratic, then your problem isn't with this or that employer or with this or that wage. Your problem is with a system that works this way, that sees a good lifestyle and a decent standard of living for its workers, not as an achievement to be cherished, an achievement to be made permanent, but on the contrary, a problem to be overcome, and then let the chips of falling wages, falling benefits, less job security, let them fall, rain down on the economic system, as they are doing in North America, Western Europe, and Japan, year after year, so long as the mass of people do not say stop. I turn now, in the final minutes of today's program, to responding to a question. And while there is a particular person, Louise, who sent in the question I chose, this is a question that basically has been asked by dozens and dozens of you over the year, and particularly in the last 3 months. I don't know exactly what explains this, but it's clear that many of you are thinking about this, feeling bad about it, so I wanted to bring it forward and talk about it. But I'm going to quote Louise. Everything seems controlled by big business. It seems as though there's nothing we can do. How can we go on? How can we maintain optimism when this seems to be a system that those at the top have really locked down to serve them at our expense? So let me respond. First of all, of course, I understand that feeling. I've shared it on occasion myself. I have friends and family who say such things from time to time. I know it's heartfelt. I know where it comes from. But I do believe it's mistaken. I guess my view here is, as an economist, but also as someone who lives and pays attention to what's happening in our society, that the old slogan, where there's a will, there's a way, makes a lot of sense. I think if you want to see the ways that change can come, you will find them, because they're there. That's not to dispute that those who run this society have a lot of levers of power, have a lot of ways to shore up, protect, and safeguard a system that serves them very well indeed. Yes, they do, and they would be very foolish folks if they didn't work very hard. They are, after all, the 1%. They are the minority. And the rest of us, for whom this system is no longer serviceable, we are the majority, and that puts them in danger, and they've figured that out, and they're trying to control the system so it doesn't threaten them. But there are signs. If there's a will, there's a way, and others have found the way. I'm going to pick just two examples, both of which hit stride last week. First, the election results. I live in New York City, and I wanted to say something about the mayoral race here in New York City. A fellow named Bill de Blasio has won the election, Democratic candidate, replacing many, many years of Republicans in the mayor's office, the latest being Michael Bloomberg, who is now very unpopular, and indeed his unpopularity was very helpful to Mr. de Blasio. Mr. de Blasio was by far the most left-wing or liberal, if you like, candidate in the big field in the Democratic primary, which he won. He came from behind when the election campaigns began. I believe he was ranked fourth and way down in the pack from the leading candidate, a woman named Christine Quinn. Ms. Quinn had the endorsement of all the major newspapers, Daily News, Post, New York Times. She was the darling of the real estate establishment that is very powerful here in New York. She had the unofficial blessing of Mayor Bloomberg, having been instrumental in getting the laws changed so he wasn't limited by two terms, was able to win a third term, which the law, when he became mayor, had made impossible. She got that law changed for him, even though she was a Democrat. But all of those blessings, more money than anybody else, more support, all the rest, all of those turned from blessings into burdens for Ms. Quinn. When the votes in the primary were counted, she came in third, and Mr. de Blasio came in fourth. Mr. de Blasio was a bit of a radical when he was a young person. The Republicans tried to smear him with charges of socialism and Marxism. That didn't go real well. In fact, didn't go anywhere at all, which is another sign of changing times that ought to tell something to people who are worried about what's possible. Mr. de Blasio won a landslide victory. I haven't seen the latest numbers, but I believe in excess of 70% of the vote in a city election, which means he's one of the most popularly elected mayors in the history of New York City. He is committed to working closely with labor unions. He is committed to taxing wealthy people in order to provide a preschool and after-school program for poor children. He is doing and saying a number of interesting things. I don't know, of course, whether he will be able to do these things, whether he will continue to champion the kinds of things he did up until now. Those are questions even he probably can't answer quite yet. We will see, and I will be reporting to you how it goes. But it is important that in the major city of the United States, the center of its financial powerhouses that are more powerful now than ever before, a Republican lost to a Democrat overwhelmingly, and the Democrats chose the most liberal from among them to be the mayor of this city. Something is changing, and I think it's worth paying attention. The second example is something I have spoken about on several occasions, and I want to bring to your attention again. This has to do with activities in the city of Richmond, California. Now, Richmond, California is already unique. It has a female mayor. Well, you say that's not so unique. Okay, but it's still relatively rare in the United States. But here comes something even more rare. The elected mayor, Gail McLaughlin, is a Green Party mayor. Now, that's rare. That exists in very few towns and cities. The Green Party of Richmond elected one of their own mayor. Wow. Wow. But the most interesting thing that she's done to date, and she's done several, and she's very popular, has been to develop a new way of using what's called the power of eminent domain. The power of eminent domain is a legal principle, and it basically says a city, any city in the United States, has the right to take private property if it's needed for the well-being of the citizens of that city. It is required to pay the owner of anything like that taken the fair market value of that item. So, for example, when a city takes land to set aside to build a school or to start a industrial park or something like that, it is required to go through a procedure, pay the owner of that land the fair market value in the market, and only then can it take the land. But the private owner must sell. So it's a power of the community. Here's what Gail McLaughlin and the city leaders of Richmond have decided to do. They are going to use the power of eminent domain to force the sale of houses in the city that are what we call underwater. That is, these houses are worth less in the market than the mortgage being paid by the people living in the house. So, for example, the people in the house owe $300,000 to the banks, but the house itself is only worth $200,000. This is causing people to abandon their homes. Their homes are getting foreclosed. The city's financial situation is deteriorating. No taxes are paid on the house. It's a crisis for the city, and the city, to benefit everybody in the city, has decided it's going to go in, buy the houses for their market value, in my example, a $200,000 house, and turn around and say to the people, cash in your $300,000 mortgage. We're going to give you a $200,000 mortgage for the same house. In other words, this act of the city forces losses on the lenders to the benefit of the borrowers and the benefit of the city. A creative new use of eminent domain. And you know what's just about it? In any real borrower and lender relationship, risks have to be taken on both sides. The lender risks he won't get the money back. The borrower risks he won't be able to pay the money back and lose his house. We have seen millions lose their homes. We have yet to see lenders lose anything comparable. But yet, the risks were on both sides. The liability is on both. What Gail McLaughlin, the Green Party mayor of Richmond, is doing is using a power for her community in a creative way. The effort of the lenders to block it is simply the effort to continue the privileges of the financial sector at the expense of everybody else. Thank you very much for your attention. This is Richard Wolff, Economic Update. And once again, I hope to see you next week. And do remember to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Thank you.